Welcome to Special Sauce 2.0, Serious Eats podcast about food and life. Every week on Special Sauce, we begin with Ask Kenji, where Kenji Lopez-Alt, Serious Eats chief culinary consultant, gives the definitive answer to the question of the week that a serious eater like you has sent us. What are your favorites to cook with your Alicia?
Alicia.
Anything that involves getting her hands messy in a bowl.
After Ask Kenji, a conversation with our guest. Today is Munchie Day on Special Sauce. Yep, Emily Kim, a.k.a. Munchie, the queen of Korean cooking on YouTube, is in the house.
I feel like eating some hot Korean noodle soup. Okay, topped with kimchi and hot pepper paste. Oh, I miss this.
And finally, on today's podcast, a teachable moment from the Serious Eats Test Kitchen.
I have a secret to share with you about no-bake cookies. It's just fudge.
First up, our chief culinary consultant, author of The Food Lab, Kenji Lopez-Alt. And Kenji, Serious Eater Little Chef's Dubai.
Okay.
Asks, what are your favorites to cook with your Alicia? Alicia.
It's Alicia. Yeah. It's the Spanish pronunciation. What do we cook together? I mean, honestly, everything. I don't repeat that many dishes at home. Like we try and cook different things every day, and she helps me almost every day. I can tell you some of her favorite activities to do. So definitely like helping make dough, helping make pancake batter. We made pancake batter yesterday morning. 2 days ago, she helped me marinate chicken breasts for the grill. So that involved picking herbs, and then we pounded some garlic in a mortar and pestle. I chopped the herbs, and then we mixed up the garlic and the herbs and a little bit of olive oil and mayonnaise in a bowl. She whisked that all together, and then we added the chicken. I butterflied the chicken breasts, and then she helped me pound them. So I put them in a plastic bag, and she kind of whacked them with the bottom of a pan. And then she, you know, she really loves getting her hands messy. So once the chicken breasts were in that bowl with the marinade, just like massaging them and turning them over and over and stuff, like she really loves that. And I think that's a nice thing to do with her, because she's at an age now where, you know, we've been doing this in the kitchen since she could stand. Since before she could stand, she's been sitting on the kitchen counter. But she's now finally at the age where I can kind of trust her and tell her like, hey, Alicia, like this is raw chicken. Don't put it in your mouth. Like, when you're done doing this, like we have to wash your hands and trust that she's not going to do that. So, you know, once you reach that phase, a whole bunch of new things open up. Like I can teach her how to use knives now and tell her to keep her hands away from the blade, tell her to keep away from hot pots and pans, et cetera. So it kind of opens up a lot of new territory for us as far as what kinds of things she can participate in. I would say her number one favorite activity and the best kitchen tool that I own for a toddler is a small mortar and pestle. So I have a large granite mortar and pestle, like a 2-cup capacity that I use. And then she has a small one that's, I think, like 3/4 or maybe 1 cup, a little marble one. And it fits her hand nicely. So whenever I'm pounding something in my mortar and pestle, which is, you know, a few times a week, almost every day, then she'll get to pound stuff too. And pounding is something that little kids love to do.
Who doesn't love to pound? So has Alicia imparted any kitchen wisdom to you, or is it still a one-way street now?
Certainly flavor-wise, she's much more experimental than me. Like, she is totally willing to smash together two things that I would think are kind of disgusting. But you know what she has taught me is obviously patience taught me to give myself more time in the kitchen during while we're cooking, because you know, if I'm cooking by myself, I go as fast as I can, and like I multitask and I do all this and all that. And oftentimes, even if I'm cooking and I'm planning like a dinner party and some guests show up early and they want to help in the kitchen, it flusters me, because I'm like, oh shit, like I'm already, like I have all these things planned. Like, I guess you could do that. You know, like it kind of flusters mm-hmm. me when people ask if they can help and I hadn't planned on people helping. Just because I have things going at a certain pace. So this has taught me to sort of take my time in the kitchen when I plan for it, you know, and make sure, all right, dinner's going to take at least half an hour, 45 minutes to make instead of 15 minutes because, like, you know, because Alicia is going to be helping me pound the garlic. It takes her much longer to peel an onion, you know. We have to set aside time so that I could talk to her about the non-uniformness of her onion slices, mm-hmm. you know, stuff like that. So I'm just kidding.
I know.
Nobody. In case anyone's afraid. I know there's people on the internet. True. People on the internet who would believe it.
Some people with a limited sense of humor here.
Nah, I think it's more just been, you know, it's good lessons on how to interact with toddlers and how to interact with adults. Like, it teaches you patience. You know, and there's this really great NPR article I read a while back about how children in South American families tend to do a lot more chores around the house, and they don't resent the chores as much as children in American families do. And the theory, and I think this has actually been is a now scientifically proved theory, that was that children in South American households tend to be given work much earlier and trusted to do it, whereas in the U.S., even me, I find myself, it's like, I'm so busy trying to get dinner done, so busy trying to get the dishwasher done, that often I'm like, all right, Alicia, like, I need to get these done now. Like, why don't you go run and play? So instead of getting her to practice doing the dishwasher and making her feel like she's sort of valued as a dishwasher or as a floor cleaner or as an assistant cook or whatever, instead she learns, all right, like, this is the time for my parents to do this. I'm going to run and play. And so the parents get stuck cleaning all the time. Whereas in South American families, they don't tend to do that. They tend to throw the kids in and say, all right, you're going to do the dishes. Like, I don't care if it takes you 45 minutes to do something that would take me 5 minutes. You're going to do them. And you find if you do that when they're little kids, and I've totally experienced this, you do it when they're really little kids, you know, from the time they're 18 months old, 12 months old, they get into it and they don't resent it. And so, you know, Alicia, like, asks to do the dishes. She asks to sweep the floor, and, you know, and she's at the point now where she can actually do it, you know, like, she can do the dishes and get them clean. It takes her longer, but, you know, it started out, of course, with many days and days of dishwater on the floor, broken dishes, all that kind of stuff, because you kind of have to let them make a mess before they learn how not to.
I wish I knew this when Will was little. I wish you'd imparted this wisdom to me.
Well, you know, everybody has their own has their own tricks. You know, I am waiting on the other foot, the other shoe to drop. Is that the phrase? What is the phrase? The other shoe to drop on her and becoming hyper picky about eating. She hasn't yet, but I hear it's coming.
You know, this enables me to give your children's book a plug, even though it's not going to be coming out for a year, right?
Oh, yes.
Have you settled on a title?
I have. The book is called Every Night is Pizza Night.
It's still called. That was my favorite. I'm glad you stuck with that.
Yeah, that's my favorite. We are sticking with it. And I actually just got all except for the cover, is the illustrations are done now. And I just got those in yesterday.
That's cool.
So it's pretty exciting. It's nice. It's nice. I can now, like, print it out and bind it myself and read it to Alicia and see how she likes it.
Thanks, Kenji. Kenji Lopez-Alt is SiriusEats Chief Culinary Consultant and the author of The Food Lab. Do send in your questions to Kenji to specialsauce@SiriusEats.com. Now it's time to meet Monchi. Monchi has introduced Korean food to millions of people through her insanely popular YouTube show that she started in 2007. How insane? Well, she's at almost 4 million subscribers and counting. Monchi is also the author of 2 best-selling cookbooks, Monchi's Real Korean Cooking, and just out, Monchi's Big Book of Korean Cooking. Welcome to Special Sauce, Monchi.
Thank you so much for having me.
Oh, my God. You caused such a stir at Sirius Eats World Headquarters when we told them that Monchi was coming on the show. It was like, wow, you really got Elvis. You got Elvis and Monchi.
Thank you.
So tell us about life at your family table growing up.
Until my junior high school, I was growing up in the city of Yeosu, South Korea, which is located the southernmost harbor city.
So how far from Seoul?
From Seoul, maybe 350 kilometers.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, so around 4 hour distance by car. And just my life when I was young was always in the southern part of Korea.
Mm-hmm.
And just the city of Yeosu is very famous for delicious seafood. Yeah, even now. And then my father was running kind of a business, the seafood auction business.
The seafood auction business.
Yeah, we were living almost on the dock, near the right on the ocean. And because in the back of the auction house, there was a room where we were staying for a while. So sometimes
The whole family was staying in that room?
Yeah, yeah. And We were very poor, but, you know, not very poor, just it's okay. I never felt we were poor, but
right.
That's our lives, right?
But you were certainly not rich.
Not rich.
Yeah.
But food is always abundant, seafood especially. Fishermen from all over, they brought their nice catchy tons of fish to sell. And sometimes they gave us for free as a gift. And that's why my house is always always delicious seafood.
Wow. And that must have been why your very first video was octopus.
First video, seafood, stir-fried squid.
Squid.
Yeah.
I'm sorry, not octopus. Yeah. So did your mother just cook the seafood very simply?
It depending on the, you know, how she cooks, or sometimes she dried fish and kind of a little semi-dried and then steamed. Later, and then later she added some seasoning sauce on top. That's amazingly delicious. Sometimes she braised, sometimes she made fish soup and fish stew, and sometimes just raw, because that's really got caught fresh fish. So we are always, every day, almost every day, we ate raw fish.
Wow. And is raw fish a thing in Korea?
Oh, yeah. It's like a Japanese version sashimi.
Uh-huh.
But in Korean, we call this hwe.
Hwe. Where?
Hwe. Okay.
I'm trying.
That's great. So the hwe is just always available. So my mom, for example, like she made that, you know, the fish is like a butterfish.
Uh-huh.
Like it look like, you know, some square shape and thin. When it's very fresh, it look like silver color. And my mom just sliced this, including bones, because bones are very smooth enough to
right.
chew. So she made a special, you know, paste, some soybean paste, hot pepper paste, lots of garlic, sesame oil, sesame seeds, and mix, and also a lot of vinegar. And we dipping into this with eating with some green chili pepper. This is a combination. This is a fantastic combination.
Wow.
But sadly, I cannot find this kind of a fresh fish here. So only I have to braise. So
got it.
Depending on the fish, how fresh it is, and also how kind of she feels that how to make this, and depending on, you know, the situation.
You're kind of like a fish whisperer, aren't
you? Exactly. Even in Yeosu, I used to, you know, go to school, elementary school, junior high school. My friends, they asked me always questions about, hey, what kind of fish is this? I always gave a joke. Any fishy question, come to me.
They were laughing. You're a fish whisperer. And so you told a story in one of the books about the way you schedule lunch at school.
Oh, yeah. This is from my first book.
Yeah. So to tell us about that.
At the time, I was elementary school.
Elementary school.
Yeah. And then I was the first child of five children for my parents. And then I was always a leader. And so that's why I started cooking in early age, maybe fourth grade, you know, but also I organize very well. So just in my classroom, I just, you know, organize it. Okay, let's make a bibimbap tomorrow. I'll bring rice and sesame oil and hot pepper paste. You guys bring this spinach. You guys bring soybean sprouts. And you guys bring one large basin. Okay, because we need to mix some kind of, we need that. And then my friends are okay. So they bring this, the very excited, everybody excited. Several people, we just organize this kind of, you know, lunch. And then, okay, they bring the just with rice and sesame oil and hot pepper paste, gochujang, and then mix all together with some chopped kimchi and all kind
of
vegetables.
Some very adventurous eating for a 10-year-old.
Yeah, not 10-year, maybe, you know, the fifth grade, you know, 12
well, okay.
or something like that. And all these girls love that. We ate some smells, you know, sesame oil smells everywhere, you know, full of this classroom. And other guys who didn't join us, and they were so envious of that, they have to eat a cold lunchbox. Looking at that. Next time, please include us.
So food was around you. You're literally living in back of the place. For a while, at least,
of
the place
couple
that
of
your
years,
dad
yeah. mm-hmm.
was auctioning off fish,
I assume
wholesaling to restaurants or whatever.
Yeah.
So you were always into food, right? Mm-hmm. Food was always. What did food mean to you at that point? Was it a way to bring people together? Like what was it that appealed to you?
Number one, I enjoy the food. Number one, because even now, I feel like eating some hot Korean noodle soup. Okay, topped with kimchi and hot pepper paste. Oh, I miss this. With the anchovy kelp stock, I make it. If I love it, I have to enjoy first.
So the first thing is you think it's seriously delicious.
Yeah, and then number two is I want to share with the people who enjoy this my own food. If people say, hey, Korean food, I don't like the Korean food. I don't like the kimchi texture. Suddenly, I don't have a power, okay?
Right.
I cannot make them very happy. So I don't feel like cooking. But anybody who around me, especially my readers, you know, they love Korean food. And I just comfortably like cooking and then sharing my food. And they love this. We just compliment each other. That's my food.
And it's been that way since you were 12.
Yeah, it's in fourth grade. Even before that, I'm the first child. My mom was a school teacher. So she always got the job, you know, island. I had to follow to her, live with her. At the time, we were living separately from my father. My father was still doing some auction business
right.
in Yeosu, the harbor city.
But you are living with him.
Yeah, my mom was got the job in Narodo Island, still southern part of some mm-hmm. island. And then my old life until like, you know, 6 or 7 years, until second grade elementary, I was, you know, living in that island
right.
with my mom. And my mom was the school teacher where I was going.
Wow.
So, and later, my mom and father just, you know, joined together in Yeosu.
They reconciled.
We moved. Yeah. No, they were just close enough, but kind of a situation is my mom had to make money. You know?
Everything's complicated, isn't it?
Yeah, yeah. But for me, just I was following my mom,
yeah.
you know. And then my mom still in Yeosu, her job was far away from the city, so she had to commute. So she came home late sometimes.
Got it.
I'm the first child, so I have to arrange some meal for my siblings.
So you were cooking for the family.
Yeah, yeah. So my siblings just arrange. First, I started to arrange, okay, kimchi, some leftover side dishes, you know, rice. You know, just I made them kind of, you know, simple meal. But later, I wanted to do some cooking. Always, like, I like to do, whenever I see my mom, grandmother, they are chopping, especially they cut into matchsticks, radish matchsticks, chop, 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 so quickly. And then I was so, I gotta do. At the time, it was maybe fourth grade. And one day, nobody was around me with one radish, my kitchen knife. I just practiced. And then while I was practicing, why I'm remembering this is that I hurt many times. My
right.
finger. My finger just sliced this.
You sliced your finger.
And then one finger was bleeding. But I didn't give up. And I gotta do this again. And maybe two or three times bleeding. So my fingers are like all bloody, you know. But still, that's the, my kind of a first matchsticks I tried
yeah,
to do.
Yeah, that's funny because, you know, every cook or chef has that story, but I don't think they ever had it when they were 12.
But I think that if I had some more wise enough or, you know, something I learned from real person,
right.
probably I wouldn't have, you know,
you
hurt
have made
my
this,
fingers.
Well, I don't know. You might have made different mistakes.
Just pretend that my mom, what she was doing, and
yeah.
then just cut my finger, but I never told my mom I hurt my finger. If I told her, she would give me hard time, tons of hard time.
Wow.
You know, why you did that, you know? So just also nobody noticed that, you know?
Yeah.
Because so many children she had, she's busy and my father is busy, you know? So kind of my life.
Wow. So were your initial career goals food oriented or no? Like,
no,
what did you think you wanted to do, even though you were bossing your friends around and telling them what to bring for lunch at the school? Like, did you think that food would play a role in your work life?
No. Food is always in my heart. Delicious food, making delicious food, recreating. But just I studied just like other people in Seoul and from high school. And then university, I have a bachelor degree in social studies.
Mm-hmm.
And social studies, after that, I wanted to study more, so I went to graduate school. I studied philosophy of education. So after that, I worked as a teaching assistant, research assistant for my advisor, professor.
Got it. So you were like, you had embarked on an academics career.
Yeah, yeah. And then I kept going. I was going to study for PhD to foreign country.
Mm-hmm.
And then I got eventually around that time, even without a PhD degree, you could work
mm-hmm.
for university. So I got that, some part-time professor at the time. I taught the philosophy of introduction of philosophy.
Wow.
Western philosophy. And then I married. So I married. Husband got the job, again, southern part, that is Gwangju. So it's a kind of mecca of kimchi.
Mm-hmm.
Even the city has a kimchi museum now.
Kimchi museum?
Yeah, so because that city is famous
for kimchi. Are there many kimchi museums or only one?
One kimchi museum.
Got it.
And they have all kinds of showing, displaying, and all, you can check out. So kimchi, I learned the totally different style of kimchi making. So now my kimchi recipe on YouTube, my website, is almost similar to Gwangju kimchi.
Got it.
So the kimchi is a really heavy paste we use. The difference is.
So your husband was an academic. You came over to the States with him initially.
Yeah, yeah.
He was getting a PhD at the University of Missouri.
Yeah, he came to Missouri as a visiting scholar, and then 3 years we lived there from 1992 to 1995. So for 3 years, there was a big, big surprise and totally opened my viewpoint about food and also other things, culture,
Uh-huh.
So because everything was, when I went, there was Columbia, Missouri. And for me, now just Columbia, Missouri is a small city. But at that time for me, wow, this is a big, America is so big. Just like when I went to Seoul for the first time from Yeosu City Girl and went to Seoul, everything was big, so many people,
right.
Transportation. And so I was dizzy, But this time, just when I went to Missouri, Columbia, and that was wow, this America is so big. And we drive this, everything's a horizon. Even I don't see any mountain here. I couldn't believe.
You were in the Midwest. You were in Missouri.
Yeah.
So then you end up moving back to Korea.
Korea, yeah.
You had two children.
Yeah, two children.
And then you and your husband ended up getting divorced.
Mm-hmm.
And at that time, were you working?
Yeah, I work. I taught English. I taught English, and because Korea is a learning English boom everywhere, and also I studied at the University of Missouri a little bit. Some course. I
mm-hmm.
took some courses, and also ESL school all the time.
Got
I
it.
Stay while I was staying. I studied there. So when I went back to Korea, a lot of people want to learn English from me. So I taught there everywhere, some cultural center, women's association, sometimes a university, so English grammar. And I was a very busy instructor at the time.
Got it.
But still, whatever I did, I was interested in making some delicious food.
So you, even when you were teaching English to elderly Korean women, you were thinking about
Western style, when our, the lecture was done and we had some party, and then I brought, now home-baked chocolate chip cookies. I brought it. Everybody, oh my God, so delicious. Oh my God. The Korean people love that also chocolate chip cookie, different the
food. So you started your culinary career in potluck suppers.
Exactly. And when I was living in Missouri, Columbia, also I met a lot of expats. So they are, PhD candidate, or they just followed their, spouse
mm-hmm.
to take care of them. We had some on a regular basis, a potluck party. Usually it happens in the, park. So usually we start with some, the Korean barbecue. But everybody has to bring one kind of a special dish. And then I learned so many different kinds of regional dish at the time. So I came from in a southern part of Korea. Mm-hmm. I lived in Seoul. In Seoul, just I studied university, only just the food that, you know, I made that kind of food, you know, never broadened my kind of cultural kind of a, you know, regional food. But when I went to the Columbia, Missouri, ironically, the expats, I learned from these ladies, you know.
Interesting.
Yeah.
So you go back to Korea with your husband. Mm. You have two little kids, maybe not so little at this point.
No, the son was about a junior high school.
Ended up getting divorced and deciding to move to, you decided to move to Toronto.
Yeah. I was going to start in USA first, because my mom is leaving. So I went to LA first. And then I tried to find the job. Not easy for me because I didn't have any, you know, the immigration status.
Mm-hmm.
And then I was looking for a job. And then later I decided my friends are living in Canada. And my best friends who used to work with me in the same institute. Oh, I forgot to tell you. I also worked in the Korean, some English institute as a, you know, teacher. So I met a lot of English native speakers. I used to help them because they are, you know, they are living in foreign countries. They need sometimes Korean translators. So I used to help them. So now they are willing to help me.
Yeah.
So in Canada, you know, my friend, you know, is living. So I went to Canada and then I got the job and just I did.
But before you got a job, I guess, as a counselor, right? I read that you worked as an extra. You did all, you had all kinds of weird jobs.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah.
I guess you were just trying to figure out a way to make it work in Toronto.
Yeah. But luckily, my English ability, mm-hmm. no matter where I go, Korean immigrants want to learn English from me.
Wow.
So
that sustained you.
Yeah, I never starve because I can teach even the tutoring, you know.
Yeah.
So I charge them and then I make, you know, enough money to survive. And but always, even in Canada, you talk about all kind of job. I was a movie extra. I was a cashier. You know, a cashier job was just right next door was some, you know, the grocery, big grocery store. I went there. I'm a who is the manager here? And then, oh, manager is over there, somebody says. I went there. Can you give me a job? I just came from Korea. I need money. And then he says, oh, can you bring your resume? And then I gave him resume next day, all kinds of good stuff. Some master degree, blah, blah, blah.
Right.
And he later called me a couple of days later. He asked me to come. He said, okay, you work here, but we don't need that, like some high education, you know, job. Just we need a cashier right now.
Right, and he wanted to make sure that you knew you were overqualified and that this is the job he had for you.
Yeah, but I was so happy to have a job because that's the one way of learning different culture.
Yeah.
So as a cashier, holy, that was a difficult job.
Yeah.
I was working with another girl, the right next to me, standing. I got a lot of hard time from her because I don't memorize PLU. You know the PLU? So anyway, that was, after that, even I was going to sell my food there. Oh, if I bring my Korean fried chicken here, people will buy and then I can make a better one here. So also,
so you made a batch of Korean fried chicken and brought it to the store?
Yeah, I asked the manager, can I bring some, you can taste first. I brought them my dakgangjeong, you know, sweet crunchy chicken, even in my cookbook. And he tasted it, but there was peanuts. I used peanuts. He has an allergy. So that's kind
bad
of a
move, Manchi.
Yeah, so that's not, I think, my destiny, you know, okay.
If did you go into anaphylactic shock? What happened?
If I sold this, well, probably Manchi never be born. Can you imagine? And the funny thing is that I made a burrito. Okay, not Korean food. There is a burrito, cold burrito. So, okay, I can make a burrito as long as I eat a lot of ingredients inside, make it plump. I made, you know, burrito, nice burrito. One guy was, he was a manager of some kind of apartment right there. he always come, stop by there. Always he take the burrito. That's his lunch. So I asked him, you wanna taste my burrito? Okay, he said, oh, yeah? So homemade burrito, who would, you know, resist? So I brought the burrito, even I didn't sell. I gave him secretly, and he taste. After that, he's addicted to my burrito. And sometimes I didn't work, you know, at the grocery store. He's waiting for me to come down from my apartment to get one burrito. So that guy was so funny. And then eventually he introduced me, oh, you know, I love your burrito. Probably your food is good. So we live, a lot of bachelors are living in my apartment. Let's do some, you know, party. So you can bring your party, the ingredient money I will pay you. So you can bring all kinds of food. So let them taste first and then they can order you. So you can make a lot of money. I was so excited. Meanwhile, I got the job. Some English teacher, some Korean Institute in Toronto. They contacted me. Okay, you got the job. So I went there.
So you eventually got a job as a family counselor helping Koreans adjust to life in the West. But then you also developed another hobby besides food, which sort of figures prominently in your story.
Yeah.
You entered the world of interactive online computer games.
Yeah. So my the Korean, the nonprofit organization, so mostly clients are Korean immigrants. And I got that job until I was working there until I left there too. For America. So before that, all this thing happening, English teacher and private tutoring and blah, blah, blah. And I was playing game. So the playing game, online game.
So did you like play games all night? You like one of these teenagers, or you were no longer a teenager who just come home from work and just play video games?
When I lived in Korea, when my children playing game, I gave them hard time. Hey, study. Don't do this playing game.
And then you become one of them.
Yeah. And then there was online game, you know, monthly $20 I had to pay. And then, but we do this kind of game. That game, I learn a lot from the game, by the way. So this game, you should not look down on that kind of game. Really fun, number one. You can spend your time, you know, instead of killing time on watching television, and you have to think. Your brain is going to be increased.
It's really funny. But you really got into it.
Yeah.
And you decided you needed an online persona.
Yeah, isn't it funny? Like 3 years I played game.
Uh-huh.
And then eventually I'm the top level.
You're a top level gamer.
Gamer, and the top level character is number 50. Level 50, I had three 50 levels. I even sent email to them, the game guys. Please make them more than 50 levels. It's boring.
I'm bored by your 50 level game.
Yeah, and then my son was the computer student. He asked me, Mom, have you ever heard of YouTube? Oh, yes. And then he said, why don't you share your recipes? You know, so my son thinks that I'm the best cook in the world.
But by that time, you had already adopted the name Manchi, right?
One of the character name. The characters, the online game, I had three characters. One is Manchi. At the time, I was playing that character. Before that, kind of a gangster's boss, Dumok, in Korean, Dumok. Everybody, American guys, called me Dumok. And they were, you know, we also playing game plus chatting together. So when they chat, they call me Dumok, and I felt good, you know. And also Sankar, double sword, you know, some kind of a name, unique name I made, but Manchi. So when I make the YouTube account, I don't know what to make, you know, the names. It has to be unique. So, okay, I'm playing Manchi. So, okay, Manchi. And then I studied like that, 2007.
Yeah, but Manchi, you wrote that my character was a tough, sexy fighter with purple hair and a big hammer.
Yeah.
I led the team to battle and knocked the biggest enemies down.
Yeah. And my character, even I told you, three, number 50 level, I never choose the game kind of defense.
Got it.
There are, you can play role play and you can defend, or you can kind of using some, you know, what is it, like some other all kinds of stuff, but I always attacking in the front. So, and then I feel so good, you know. So one of my friends, online game friends, he asked me, Manchi, next time why don't you be a bit defender? So I said, I would never be a defender.
And what does Manchi mean?
Manchi's hammer in Korean.
Hammer. Yeah. So you were the hammer.
Yeah.
Don't strike me as the hammer type. Yeah. So then your son suggests, oh, Mom, you know, you should do, you're a really good cook. You should put some cooking videos up on YouTube.
Yeah.
And you started in 2007.
Yeah, yeah.
And I watched the first one.
Mm-hmm.
The Morrissey soundtrack, it's not mixed all that well.
I don't make any money from that video because I use the Morrissey music.
Right.
Copyright, you know? So I have a bunch of...
But you didn't know about copyright. Everyone was violating copyright in 2007.
Even also, I didn't know I would be popular someday. You know,
right.
I'm the one of the millions of people. So just to make it fun, you know, okay, I love Morrissey music. I just add it and a bunch of all these videos, I don't make money at all now.
Yeah.
But it's okay.
And yeah. Did you ever think in your wildest dreams that you would actually make money from this?
Never. And I never be interested in making money from this. This is hobby.
Right.
Totally my hobby. But it's like a one by one, my recipe. Thanks to YouTube, I'm very loyal to YouTube because I will never be against YouTube. Because of YouTube, I just could share all my recipe all around the world.
And it took over your life in
exactly.
the best possible way.
Yeah, exactly. So, you know, I never thought that I would be popular. I would never think that I would make money from this, you know. So, but this is my hobby, good hobby. And by time goes by, my recipe video is going to be just like encyclopedia for myself. It'll be good. When I get older, okay, how many cups I use this? And then I can go back to my own, you know,
right.
the things. And then I can find easily. So
you're living the Korean-American dream.
Thank you so much.
So we have to leave it right here for this episode, but I still have a lot of questions for you. So Manchi, thank you so much for being on Special Sauce.
Thank you so much, and nice meeting you.
Nice to meet you. And now it's time to head over to the Serious Eats Test Kitchen, where our pastry wizard, Stella Parks, author of Brave Tart, Iconic American Desserts, will lead us through the creation of a killer confection. Details of Stella Parks' recipe are at SeriousEats.com.
No-bake cookies are a thing that a lot of people make, their grandmothers make, their family makes, holiday classic, but they're a little notorious in that sometimes they don't set up, and sometimes they're too dry and crumbly, and who knows what's going on. I have a secret to share with you about no-bake cookies. It's just fudge. It's ingredients in a pot, cooked to a specific temperature, cooled and stirred. That's really not a big deal, I promise. And if you've got a digital thermometer, especially one that clips onto the side of the pot, you can know with 100% certainty what temperature your fudge is being cooked to for no-bake cookies. And that means you'll have success every time. Let's go. First ingredient. Sugar. I'm using toasted sugar. It's really great in any kind of candy that can sometimes be borderline a little too sweet, just because it adds some complexity of flavor and a little bit of like caramelly oomph. White sugar is fine, or toasted sugar if you have it. A little bit of milk, Dutch cocoa powder, and a little bit of salt. Salt is a powerhouse ingredient here because it is what brings out the flavor of the chocolate. So a little bit of salt. Turn the heat up and bring this to a boil. I'm gonna whisk just to bring it all together, make sure all the lumps of sugar disappear, and just let it go until it comes to a boil. While this is coming to a boil, I'm gonna set the alarm on my thermometer. The cool thing about leave-in thermometers like this is what you would use to temp a roast turkey or chicken or something that's in the oven. It's got a long cord. You can use it for bread, other things like that. I love to use it for candy making because I don't want a single-use thermometer, candy thermometer. I literally don't have a candy thermometer. It's the only kind of thermometer I have. I'm gonna set this temperature alert. The recipe is gonna cook to 230 degrees, so I'm gonna set the temperature alert 2 degrees below that. And that means when it comes time for me to cook this, I don't have to watch it like a hawk. I can check my phone, I can get on Twitter, I can hang out with you guys. It will let me know when it comes to temperature. Your handheld thermometer can't do that. Oh look, that means I'm almost there. 2 degrees to go. I'll get off Twitter, start paying attention to what I'm doing. Okay, it's hit 230, shutting off the heat, removing my thermometer. Next up, gonna add a bit of melted dark chocolate. I like the combination of chocolate and cocoa powder together in the cookies. I think it gives a little bit stronger of a chocolate flavor. Creamy peanut butter. This is definitely a time for commercial peanut butter. You want smooth, creamy, creamy peanut butter. Natural styles may be more inclined to break. The emulsion won't hold in the high heat. And a big splash of vanilla. And once all the peanut butter and chocolate looks like it's mixed in pretty evenly, we're gonna add some instant oats and some old-fashioned oats. When I was testing, I did some batches with all instant, some batches with all old-fashioned, and then I did a batch with a little bit of both, and that was my favorite in the end. The instant oats dissolve a little bit better and create a more traditional cookie structure, but the old-fashioned oats kind of retain a little bit of a nibby characteristic that reminds me of a heartier kind of oatmeal cookie. So I'm gonna keep stirring until this starts to thicken. This is a little bit like that stage when people make fudge in a fudge shop and they've got it on the marble slab and they're scraping and stirring it, only we're just stirring it. It's starting to thicken up a little bit. So I'm going to bring my baking sheet a little closer, grab a pair of spoons, start scooping. Be careful, you don't want to burn yourself. This stuff is ridiculously hot. It's 230 degrees. This looks like a delicious gooey mixture of chocolate you just want to stick your finger into and like, taste it. But it's too hot, don't do it. The no-bake cookies need to cool until they're room temperature. Up until that point, their texture is gonna continue to be evolving. So you might taste one 30 minutes after you make it, but they're still a little bit warm. And you might think to yourself, this isn't the texture I was expecting. It's because it hasn't cooled yet. Just let it keep going. Oh yeah, it's soft, it's chewy. Oh no, these are good. I'm good at my job. Pretty proud of myself.
Again, details of Stella Park's recipe are at SeriousEats.com. More from our test kitchen next time. That's it for today. Next week on Special Sauce, Kenji will be back to answer, with his usual scientific precision, your culinary question of the week. Do send in those questions to SpecialSauce@SeriousEats.com. All this and a special guest on next week's Special Sauce. So long, Serious Eaters. See you next time.